I'd like to welcome everyone tonight. We're going to continue our little study. This is kind of a crossover lesson between the tabernacle and the book of Revelation. So I'm going to go ahead and tell you from the get-go, this lesson's a little bit out there. And from that coming from someone who really likes the study of Revelation, when they say it's pretty out there, you know it's pretty out there. But this is a neat little story, and I like to tell it. And so it's the story, and I've entitled Camping Around the Tabernacle. And so we get this image, and we've talked about the tabernacle, and we've talked about the different parts, and we've talked about the different rooms and who was allowed in where and where the different furniture sat. But we also have to remember that the tabernacle was somewhat the center of the Hebrew life. And so as the story goes, the glory of God, that Shekinah light, would dwell right there in the most holy place. It would dwell right there on the between the cherubims, as they say. And as soon as that light would get up and move, that was the signal that the children of Israel were going to have to move the tabernacle. And so they would follow that light around to wherever the light would stop, and then they would reset up the tabernacle, and they would also recamp. I don't know if you ever really thought about this before. This was a massive, massive undertaking. I'm guessing the population, it doesn't say a total population, but it tells us that the fighting men made up 600,000 men. So if you take all the children and you take all the men above the fighting age and you take all the women, some estimates put this at over 2 to 3 million people that would have to move their camp to follow the light to set up around the tabernacle. Can you imagine the utter chaos that would have entered? I try to think back to my days at Lakeview High School, and there'd be times that we would have to have practice to evacuate the building. We'd have a fire drill. And you try to round up 1,000 kids and get them into the right spot, it's tough. This was over 1 million, maybe 2 million. Some estimates say 3 million people would have to be relocated in an orderly fashion to reestablish their camp around the tabernacle. That would be like moving Fort Worth. We're not talking about just a handful of folks. We're talking about a huge operation that had to be done to move the tabernacle. Numbers chapter 2, verse 2 for an introduction. It says, every one of the children of Israel shall camp by his own standard beside the emblems of his father's house. They shall camp some distance from the tabernacle of meeting. So what we're going to have here is, and I've got some pictures, crudely drawn illustrations. The tabernacle is going to be in the middle, and then the children of Israel would camp around the tabernacle. And it was very, very specific how they were to camp, what direction certain tribes were to go in. You couldn't do just all hooly-gooly. It wasn't a helter-skelter fire drill where everybody just ran out. No, it was very ordered and structured how the children of Israel were to set up the camp around the tabernacle. And from that, hopefully we can get a pretty neat little story that comes from it. Before we go further, though, let's take time right now to go to God in a word of prayer. Well, here's a picture. It's my crudely drawn diagram here. And you may have some of these in your Bibles. In fact, I've found several that look something along these lines when it shows how the tabernacle was arranged and how the camps were set up around the tabernacle. It was very, very specific as to how the camps were to be set up. If you notice, some of these names are in red. Dan, Ephraim, Reuben, and Judah are all in red. And then the other tribes are all in black. The reason I did that is because each one of these quads, I guess you could call it, these groups, these clusters of three, the guy in red was in charge. So the family that's in red, that was the group that was in charge of that area. And I'll show you some verses here in a minute to prove that. So Ephraim, Dan, Judah, and Reuben were in charge of each group. Now I want you to keep in mind, this is a tremendous amount of people. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of people at each location, to the north, to the south, to the east, and to the west of the tabernacle. So, I've seen a lot of pictures that look like that. But I'm here to tell you, I don't believe that's the complete picture. So we're going to have to add to it as we go through our study tonight. But we'll start here. So how many people were camping? Well, approximately 600,000 fighting men were listed at the census as they began to go through the wilderness. So if we begin to add women and children, if we begin to add the aged men who were no longer considered part of the fighting force, said anywhere from 2 to 3, I've even seen 4 million people. So it's a huge group of people that were camping around the tabernacle. Now, in our introduction, we read something about the standard and its ensign. So what would happen here on the standard, they would try to get the order to the chaos. Each tribe had its own banner. And so there was some type of flag, I don't know what it looked like, but there was some type of banner that each tribe used. So if you could imagine the utter chaos of 2 million people trying to figure out where they're supposed to go and where they're supposed to line up and who's supposed to camp where and where my, we can't even get a group of Boy Scouts to do it. Can you imagine doing it with 2 to 3 to 4 million people? So to help that, what God allowed them to do, they had their own banner or their own standard, and the Bible uses the word ensign. I don't know what that means. Most of what I'm going to tell you tonight is right out of the Bible. Towards the end, I'm going to have to tell you a little bit about Jewish tradition because it adds a little to it. Some of the tradition talks about the different colors that these standards, these big old flags that you can see from a distance. I almost imagine it being like at a World Cup soccer game where there's just hundreds of thousands of people packed into a stadium. And if you want to know where your people are, who's rooting for the same team, you look for the big flags that are waving up in the stands. It was used as a visual symbol. So they'd have these big old standards up there. I read one guy, and he had all the colors listed. One was red, one was gold, one was green, one was blue. And then I read another guy, and he had all four of them different. So I don't know what the colors were. The Bible never mentions it. All it says is that there were standards and there were ensigns. If you want to read that verse again, it was, go back here, Numbers 2 and 2. It says, every one of the children of Israel shall camp by his own standard. That's it. They're supposed to camp beside their banner so that the tribes would stay where they were supposed to stay. The tribe of Dan could move out to the west. That's not where they were supposed to be. The tribe of Reuben couldn't move out to the east. That's not where they were supposed to be. So they had to find their standard and their emblems. The King James Version renders that ensigns. So it's the symbol that was on the standards. And so that helped everybody get into the right spot. Four tribes served as the leaders of each quad. And those are the four that we have listed in red. The Bible is extremely specific. And so we're going to read one of them. I'm not going to read all four because they're basically the same, but I'll read one just to give you an idea. Dan was to be in the north. Judah was to be in the east. Reuben was to be in the south. And Ephraim was to be in the west. And every time the tabernacle was set up, that was the pattern that God gave. That's how the tribes camped around the tabernacle. And their particular banner represented all the tribes in that particular direction. So Dan, being the leader of his quad, his flag, his banner, gave direction for those other two tribes to come together. Kind of get an interesting story. I don't know that I'd ever studied too much about that. It's pretty neat. It's going to get even neater. So here's our story again. Here's our picture. So each one of these red, Ephraim, Dan, Reuben, and Judah, had a standard. They had some type of a flag. I have no idea what it looks like. I'm kind of imagining something like that. But maybe that's kind of too Romanish. I don't know. I'm just kind of imagining that. I don't know if it was a banner like that, look like a flag, like we think of it. I don't know. I've seen some images, but these are just people's ideas as well. I can tell you the Jewish tradition, but I don't know exactly what it looked like. But these banners would help to lead the people to the right spot so that they did not get out of order around the tabernacle. If you notice something, though, there's two tribes missing. There's supposed to be 12 tribes of Israel. There's supposed to be 12 sons of Israel. Well, we're missing two. So we need to discuss that for a little bit. We're missing Joseph and we're missing Levi. Those were two of the original 12. They're not listed in the grouping in the camp arrangements outside the tabernacle. Joseph is the easiest one to fix. The tribe of Joseph was split among his two twin sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And so as Jacob blessed, or as they blessed, he blessed his children as he was dying, he made sure to mention that Ephraim and Manasseh were to be considered joint, these two twin boys. And so you don't read about the tribe of Joseph. You read about the tribe of Ephraim and Manasseh. It's So that takes care of one of them. Now the second one is Levi. The tribe of Levi is not mentioned. That's because the tribe of Levi were to be servants of the tabernacle, and they were to live even closer to the tent of meeting than what we just saw. So our picture then has to be fixed. Let's go ahead and read Numbers chapter 2. I told you I'd read one of them. So we'll read Numbers chapter 2. We'll start in verse 3. All four of the quads are described in the same way, but I'll just pick the east side. Then on the east side, toward the rising of the sun, those of the standard of the forces with Judah shall camp according to the armies, and Nashon, the son of Abinadab, shall be the leader of the children of Judah. And he goes on in verse 5, it speaks about Issachar, and the leader of Issachar was to be Nethaneel. And in verse 6, it talks about Zebulun, and the leader of Zebulun, or the elder of Zebulun, was to be Eliab. And so all four quads are described in the same way. It gives us a direction. It tells us whose standard we were to follow. So on the east side, you were to follow the standard of Judah. And they knew what that meant. They knew the color. They knew the symbol. They knew what to look for. And so it was Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. And each one of these had a ruler or had an elder, the patriarch of the family. But the one that was in charge was Judah, and the ruler of Judah was Nashon. So he's the man. He is the most powerful man in this quad. I said all four quads are described in the exact same way. It tells who's in charge, what standard to follow, and it talks which man is in charge of that family as well as the leaders of the individual families. Numbers 2 and 34 says, thus the children of Israel did according to all that the Lord commanded Moses. So they camped by their standards, and so they break camp, each one by his family, according to their father's houses. So when they got ready to move, they did it in an orderly fashion. It says they broke camp according to family. And so they knew which family went first, and which family went second, and which family went third, in order to prevent chaos when these 2 to 3 to 4 million people needed to move, when the tabernacle needed to move. So there we go. Numbers 3, verse 5. Let's talk about Levi now. It says, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, bring the tribe of Levi near, and present them before Aaron the priest, that they may serve him. And they shall attend to his needs and the needs of the whole congregation before the tabernacle of meeting, to do the work of the tabernacle. So this tribe of Levi is to be completely separate and set apart from the other tribes. In fact, they were not even counted together in the census. It was done completely separate. They were in their own entity. The tribe of Levi was not to be mixed with the other tribes. Now something interesting happens in Numbers 3 and 17. It says, and these were the sons of Levi by their name. And it mentions it. There's Gershon and Kohath and Merari. And you probably never even thought about these three words. I think I've heard of Kohath before, just because I remember Dathan and Neighbor, the two that rebelled against Moses were of the tribe of Kohath. I remember that. But other than that, I don't know much about these tribes. Dathan and Abram, I said the name wrong, but they were of that tribe of Kohath. But the Lord makes sure to mention these people specifically. And then he goes on to say in Numbers 3 and 23, the families of the Gershonites were to camp behind the tabernacle westward. And the leader of the father's house of the Gershonites was Eliasaph, the son of Lael. And again, I'm not going to read all of them. I'm just going to read the first one to you. But again, it took all three of those children, the sons of Levi, and it specifically told them where to camp, which side of the tabernacle they were to camp on, and it told who the leader of the family was to be. In this case, the Gershonites was Eliasaph. Okay, so now we've got to add something to our picture. So I had to get creative now, so I had to put some yellow in here. I had to add. So we've already got our 12 right here. And then we've got Merari, Gershon, and Kohath that were to, the three sons of Levi, were to live closer to the tabernacle, it says. They were to live even closer than everybody else because they were to be the servants of the tabernacle. So as you can imagine, as the tribes would disperse, you had to get everybody out of the way first, and then these guys could go to work on taking care of the tabernacle. And each group here had special jobs as to how they took care of the tabernacles. Some would move one thing, some would move another. They all had very, very specific jobs. So we kind of had to update our picture a little bit. Numbers 3 and 18. Another interesting verse. So it already mentioned the three sons of Levi. Numbers 3 and 18 says, and these are the names of the sons of Gershon by their families, Libni and Shimei. So now we've gone another generation. These are the grandsons of Levi. Calls them by name. He didn't call anybody else by name, but he makes sure to say who is in charge of the families, these grandchildren of Levi. So now we have the next generation. So here we have the three sons of Levi, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. And again, I didn't read all three of them, but each time it goes in and it lists the grandchildren. So these are the grandchildren of Levi. And they too had a special job to do and a special place to camp. They could not camp where they wanted to. They were Levites. They had to camp where God told the Levites to camp. So we're very specific. We have the 12 tribes, and now we've got the sons of Levi, and now we have the grandchildren of Levi. It's getting interesting, isn't it? Okay, my picture is getting a little ugly now. I had to add to it, though. So here's my tabernacle. Here are my three sons of Levi. And then in the boxes, I had to add all of the grandchildren of Levi. And they had to camp in a certain spot of the tabernacle, directionally speaking. Oh, Mushi here, who was Levi's grandson, had to camp to the north of the tabernacle. This tribe did not have a choice. And they were told, Libni was told, you're going to be over there, you're going to be on the west side of the tabernacle with Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin. They all had their place where they were to be camped around the tabernacle. So my picture is getting a little messy now. I don't think I've ever seen that picture in any dictionary or Bible study book. I've never seen that. But that's what it looked like. Numbers 3 and 38. We got an empty side. Y'all notice we have an empty side? The only place that's empty is the east side of the tabernacle. Right? Do you remember that everything always opened from the east? Everything in the tabernacle always opened from the east. That's where the priest went in. Everything entered from the east. Numbers 3 and 38 says, moreover, those who were to camp before the tabernacle on the east, before the tabernacle of meeting, were Moses, Aaron, and his sons, keeping charge of the sanctuary to meet the needs of the children of Israel. So who's going to be on the east? I had to add one more box, and now I'm finished. On the east, we have the family of Aaron. So there's our picture. So when the tribes camped around the tabernacle, that's how they were to line themselves up. Every single time, without question. And we notice how each group was designated who the ruler and who the leader of this group of people were. Everybody had a spot in the hierarchy that God has set forth. They didn't get to do their own thing. They had to follow the pattern. So I'm going to try real careful to see if I can slip this word in. Each group had a leader. It had a patriarch. It had an elder that told them what to do. And now we go to Revelation. Revelation chapter 4. Very, very interesting passage. Revelation chapter 4 is a vision into the throne room of heaven. It says, and after these things I looked, and behold, a door standing open in heaven. And the first voice which I heard was like a trumpet speaking with me, saying, come up here, and I will show you things which must take place after this. So we have this introduction into the throne room of heaven. Revelation 4 and 4. It says, and around the throne were 24 thrones. And on the thrones I saw 24 elders sitting, clothed in white robes. And they had crowns of gold on their head. And from the throne proceeded lightnings, thunderings, and voices. Seven lamps of fire were burning before the throne, which are the seven spirits of God. Did you pick up on all the tabernacle type language that was used in that passage? I don't think there's anybody in the world that'll deny, we start talking about the most holy place of the tabernacle, that is a symbol of heaven. And I haven't found anybody that disagrees with me on that. Whoever you look, it is very obvious that from the tabernacle to the temple, where that most holy room was, remember, it was completely dark. It was separated by the veil. All that was in there was the Ark of the Covenant. And that's where God would come down, and he would sit upon the Ark of the Covenant there on the mercy seat between the cherubims. I have never found anyone that doesn't make the connection between the tabernacle, the most holy place of the tabernacle, and the analogy of heaven, where God reigns and where God is on the throne. Did you notice that phrase about lightning, thunderings, and voices? Did you pick up on that phrase? That is the exact same terminology that is used when Moses went up to Mount Sinai to get the Ten Commandments. So anyone that reads that said automatically, oh, he's making a reference back to Moses in the time of the Ten Commandments. It said when Moses went up to get the Ten Commandments, there were lightning, thunderings, and voices. Did you pick up the seven lamps of fire, which represent the seven spirits of God? Have we ever heard of anything in the tabernacle about seven lamps of fire? Absolutely. That's what that golden candlestick was. It specifically says it was to be a golden candlestick made out of one solid piece of gold beaten into seven lamps. So there's references are just everywhere and allusions that ought to be drawing our mind back to the time of the tabernacle, even though John is talking about a vision of heaven. And I tried to sneak the word in. Did you pick up the 24 seats around the throne and the 24 elders? Okay, go back to your picture. Have you ever counted them? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. We had 12 of the tribes. Now count the sons, 13, 14, 15. And now count the grandsons. 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, and who occupied the fourth one was Moses and Aaron. Is that not an amazing picture? That around the tabernacle were 24 rulers, 24 elders, 24 patriarchs, 24 men who were in charge, and they surrounded the tabernacle. And then we get to the book of Revelation, and we no longer see this as a tabernacle. No, it says we see this as the throne of heaven with all sorts of references back to the tabernacle, all sorts of literary figures of speeches and allusions that this tabernacle is representative of heaven. And then we have 24 thrones with 24 elders surrounding, just like it was set up as they camped around the tabernacle. Is that not one of the most amazing stories you've ever heard? You know, sometimes we look for big things. We look for God to present himself in big ways. Aaron and I were reading last night about Elijah. Remember how Elijah was there in the mountain? He was depressed. He was sad. And God said, come out, I want to show you something. And there was a great wind that came by, and just like a tornadic wind. And it said God wasn't in the wind. And then here came a great fire, but God wasn't in the fire. And then here came a great earthquake. God wasn't in the earthquake. Remember where God was? It was a soft whisper. You know, sometimes God is found in the smallest things, in the details. And I think that's what we have here in the 24 thrones. I've often thought about the 24, and I probably even said this when I looked at it the first time. I saw the 24 elders is probably a combination of 12 and 12. The 12 apostles from the New Testament, the 12 tribes of Israel from the Old Testament. And I'm not 100% convinced that that's not true in some form or fashion. But I certainly now see the connection with the tabernacle and the 24 elders which surrounded the tabernacle, just like we have in the book of Revelation. I got one more for you, and then I'll close. This is where I got to go into Jewish tradition. Revelation 4, verse 6. And in the midst of the throne and around the throne were four living creatures full of eyes in front and in back. The first living creature was like a lion. The second living creature like a calf. The third living creature had the face like a man. And the fourth living creature was like a flying eagle. So we have these four grotesque, scary, hideous beasts with these four faces. And there's some reference back to Ezekiel, I believe it's chapter 10, of some of the same imagery. We got the lion, the calf, the creature like a man, and the flying eagle. Remember the standards? I told you I'd have to go back to Jewish tradition. These are what the standards, what some look like. Dan was an eagle. Reuben was a man. Ephraim was a bull. And Judah was a lion. So I don't know. Isn't that an amazing picture, though, that the pictures of these four faces were the same as what the Jewish historians for years had claimed were the standards that were set up on each side in each cardinal direction of the tabernacle. And now we have these same four faces. You know, there's a lot of controversy about this. Dan, remember when Dan was blessed by Jacob, he said he was going to be a serpent. He was a snake. So sometimes they might have a picture of a snake up there. What I understood, they didn't like walking around with a picture of a snake. So they found the snake's greatest enemy, which is the snake, which is the eagle. And also I've read, Dan is also said to be a judge. And throughout the scriptures, the eagle is seen as a symbol of divine judgment. So I don't know if that's where that comes from or not. Reuben is sometimes shown as a man. Other times he's shown as a flower. It's what's called a mandrake, which goes back to one of the stories involving Rachel. And so sometimes you may see it as a man, a face of a man. Other times you may see it as a mandrake. These two down here are pretty consistent. Ephraim is a bull, and Judah, of course. Judah is always seen as the symbol of the lion. So I can't speak to that from the scriptures. I can just tell you what the Jewish tradition says. But doesn't that make you feel a whole lot better about these four beasts, that maybe they're not as scary and grotesque as what we thought? Maybe they have meaning in one of these Old Testament stories. So in conclusion, it appears to be, we've talked about this a lot now, that much of the book of Revelation is based on images common to those that understood the Bible. And where we get into trouble is when we have no understanding of the Bible. And we've got people that don't even know what the tabernacle is, but are out there espousing their views on Revelation. And yet they don't know any of the precursing knowledge. They know none of the prerequisite knowledge. They don't know any of the signs and the symbols. They don't understand any of the Old Testament references, but because they're loud and because they have internet, they become experts. They begin to put forth all of their ideas when they don't understand the basic knowledge. And remember, I invented my own way of interpreting the book of Revelation. It's the biblical historical. And I think we always need to start with the biblical words, start with the stories of the Bible first. If there's an allusion to something or a reference to something in the Old Testament, that's where we need to start if we want to get understanding. Because if not, pretty easy to get yourself taken away in a hurry on the book of Revelation. So that concludes my thoughts.